Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, November 2nd, 2014. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. This is the first show of the month of November, and don't look now, but this year is rapidly slipping away. For me, it just seems like New Year's Eve was last week. So we have a brand new month and a fascinating show for you tonight. Before we launch into conversation with our guest about an incredible movie that we're all going to want to see, I want to take a bit of time to talk about something else. One of the realities of this challenging and often painful time that we live in is how lonely so many of us feel knowing what we know and attempting to live our lives with passion and purpose. We sometimes lose sight of the fact that one of the most precious treasures we have right now in this time of extinction is our connections, our relationships with all beings and with life itself. So on November 6th, that is this coming Thursday night, I'm going to be launching a webinar of 6 sessions entitled Relationships in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, How Do We Love and How Do We Leave? It's going to begin, as I said, on November 6th and will end December 18th. And the webinar is going to feature some incredible, amazing guest speakers, including Dr. Linda Bender, author of the book Animal Wisdom and a recent guest on the Lifeboat Hour, Guy McPherson, who needs no introduction for most of you, Jack Adam Weber, doctor of Chinese medicine and also a recent guest on this show, Francis Weller, who many of you have come to know from his appearances on the Lifeboat Hour and his work on grief, and Anne Amberg, who came on the show back in June to talk about our relationship with the universe, what the universe does, and how it does it, what it does through us. I've been advertising this event all over Facebook and on my website, but the fastest way to register is to visit www.syncast.net. That is spelled S-Y-N-C-H-C-A-S-T, syncast.net. And you'll find all the details there, including instructions for registration and for registration with the early bird special for the webinar. This is a fabulous opportunity to connect with other like-minded souls, to question these guests, to ask them something maybe you've always wanted them to tell you, and to experience a beautiful completion of 2014. As I said, the fastest way to get to the registration page for this webinar is to go to syncast, syncast.net, and register there. So this coming Thursday night, I hope to see you at the webinar with our first guest, Dr. Linda Bender, author of Animal Wisdom. So my friend Andrew Harvey just recently informed me of a movie highlighting the lives of the indigenous Kogi people in Colombia and the message that they're giving to the world. It turns out that in 1990, a BBC documentary brought global attention to the Kogi people, who were determined to caution us about environmental damage to the earth. And now, 2 decades later, and convinced that their message has gone unheeded, the new generation, the next generation of Kogi, are reaching out to the world once more with a much more specific warning about the future of the planet. And tonight, we are incredibly fortunate to have with us the director of ALUNA, Alan Herrera, spelled E-R-E-I-R-A, and I'm going to be asking him a number of questions about this movie and how we can obtain it. Alan Herrera is an award-winning British documentary filmmaker and author. Educated at Queen's College, Cambridge, he joined the BBC in 1965, producing radio and TV documentaries for 30 years and contributing films to the Time Watch Strand, among others. Herrera's 1990 film, From the Heart of the World, The Elder Brother's Warning, and the accompanying book, The Elder Brother's Warning, charted his visits to the Kogi people in Colombia at that time. Herrera collaborated with Terry Jones of Monty Python fame on the documentary series Crusades, 1995, Terry Jones' Medieval Lives, 2004, and Terry Jones' Barbarians, 2006, with whom he also co-authored the respective companion books. We are so fortunate to have Alan with us tonight. And Alan Herrera, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, and please correct me if I'm mispronouncing your name.
No, I think you pronounced it the same way that I do, and it's probably me that mispronounces it. Hello, and it's very nice to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And first of all, Alan, I'd like you to give us a much more detailed background on this movie and how you decided to get involved. And please feel free to take us back to the roots of your involvement in terms of the BBC film, and also tell us what actually drew you to do a documentary about the Kogi.
Well, it's a story that begins when I was making a series on the Spanish Armada. And the part of the story of the Spanish Armada, the reason why Spain wanted to attack, invade, conquer Britain, England, was because of the attacks that the English sailors were making on the Spanish treasure fleets from South America. And the gold that I wanted to talk about was in the Gold Museum of Bogota, so off I went happily to the Gold Museum of Bogota. The BBC then sent an inquiry to me saying that a archaeological site had turned up in Colombia, which was being called the Lost City, and it sounded really very interesting, and would I go and have a look at it and see if there was a film to be made about the Lost City. So I went off full of trepidation, never having been into a jungle before in my life, to find the Lost City. But on the way and doing my research, I discovered that there were a lot of other cities that were still functioning, belonging to the people that had built the Lost City. And it was obvious, I thought, that the way to make a film about an archaeological site like this was actually to go to people who were living in such a city and who had built such a city and ask them what it was for and how it worked. Because after all, we know these great sites like Machu Picchu and so on, but we don't actually know how any of these cities function really. So here was an opportunity to learn something completely new. The one little obstacle was that the reason these people were still around was because they had cut themselves off from the outside world as completely as they possibly could. And this was the key to surviving the Spanish conquest and everything that followed it. So there was an intact pre-Columban civilization on a very steep, difficult, pretty much inaccessible mountain in northern Colombia, with thousands of people living as they had lived at the time when the Lost City was an occupied city. But they didn't want anybody from the outside world to come anywhere near them. But I also heard that they were very pessimistic and that they felt that their purpose in existing was to take care of the world. And I thought, well, if that's so, then perhaps they would want to inform us of something because they might be very pessimistic about their own future and feel they had a moral obligation to let us know. So I arranged to have messages sent to them through intermediaries, which simply said, if you want to speak to the world, I can help you. And it turned out that they had been waiting for just such a message. And I sent three messages to three different communities, three different cities on the mountain. And 6 months later, a reply came from each of them, and the reply was identical. It said, we're waiting to work with you. Come. Well, you don't turn that sort of invitation down. So 6 months after that, I make my way to Colombia. And I have an anthropologist in tow to guide me. And this anthropologist, I I decided I'd better have a female anthropologist because I thought it was going to be important that I should not present them with an all-male party, because that's exactly what they were hiding from and had been hiding from for 400 years. And she warned me that I must be prepared to meet people who looked prematurely aged and sick, and I mustn't be shocked by the sight of these sad, impoverished, desperate indigenous people. When I finally got up there, I find myself in above the jungle. This is a very high mountain they live on, the highest coastal mountain in the world. I'm up at a level where it is cooler, where there's kind of open savanna. It's a very steep landscape, but with woods rather than forest, and with open areas of grassland and pasture. And then the Kogi people begin arriving. I'm at a village, a small city. And the Kogi people begin arriving, and they're arriving, and they are beautiful. They don't look prematurely aged. They don't look sick. They look spectacular. They look like something out of myth. People wearing white robes and no shoes, with hair cascading down over their shoulders, with an air of tremendous dignity, riding fine-looking mules in beautiful condition with red woven harness. And my jaw is on my chest. And I'm in this strange, mythic world.
Right.
Of something that comes out of a story, that we know this story. Somewhere on a mountain hidden is a secret civilization that has been watching us for centuries and decides, we will speak to you. We all know that myth. Well, it turns out it was real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I find myself. And I am summoned that night to a big circular meeting house where there are some 200 men gathered. And it's in the dark with four fires burning, all of them wearing their white robes, seated around the fires. And they have one translator who they've trained, who speaks Spanish and speaks their language, Kogi. And his role, he's been waiting for years. He's been trained years ago. They were waiting for the moment when this would happen. And out of the dark comes his voice. You have come to speak to us. So speak. And so I begin to explain some concept of where I've come from, and that if they do want to speak to the world, what I can bring them are machines, a machine which is an eye that remembers and an ear that remembers. And when I take it back, I can show people, them speaking. I can show, the Kogi can appear in front of the whole world because of this machine. And people will see them and hear them, and it will be as though they have come to the door of this house, but they won't actually have to be there. So this may be what you would like to do. And I also explain the risks involved as I understand them, that it will attract people to them, that they will have lost their secrecy, they will cease to be hidden, they will be exposed to all the dangers that they have been hiding from for 400 years. And then I think that there may be reasons why they would want to do this, and I suggest what those are, which are to do with the importance of the job they have of taking care of the world, and that they need to get us on board with that process. But I am not in a place where I can tell them what they should do or should not do. They must make a decision. And when they tell me their decision, if they say no, they will never see me again. And I won't understand the reason why they make that decision. And at that point, 200 men grunt. And I am told, and I explain a bit about the camera, and I say, I've brought a camera and you can have a look at it and you can see what it does. And I'm told, go away. We will consult through the night. we will climb to the top of the mountain, we will hold a divination, and we will be told what to do by the Great Mother, and then tomorrow we will speak to you again and tell you what the Great Mother has decided. Which gives me a sleepless night, as you might expect.
Of course.
And the following day, I'm summoned to a different house, and this is in the daytime. And they're now arranged in rows, and I am in front. And one of them says, there are a row of old men, there are five old men in the front. And one of the old men says, do you have a machine that remembers what we say? All this is going through a translator. And I say, yes, I do. Turn on your machine. And then they begin, these five men in turn, telling a story. And the story begins, in the beginning, there was neither sun nor moon. There was nothing at all, only a luna. And a luna was not a person. She was thought. And a luna began to think. And they tell the story of how a luna's thought is memory and possibility. And eventually, having thought long and hard about creating a cosmos, a world, a luna opens a space between memory and possibility, which is, of course, a space between the past and the future.
Right.
And that is the material world. That is what you are experiencing. The space between memory and possibility. And then comes the creation of the world, and I'm now listening to the whole, a Bible, which they're taking it in turns to tell me. This is, you know, the book of Genesis and
right.
on.
Right.
The creation of humanity, whose task it is to take care of the world. The world is created, humanity is created to take care of it, and to connect with Aluna. And respond to Aluna, and is responsible to Aluna. And then Aluna creates a new form of humanity, a second form, which is called the younger brother. And the younger brother doesn't know how to behave and is ultimately expelled. And I realize what I'm listening to is the story of Adam and Eve. This is the expulsion mm-hmm. from the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And in this story, they are still in the Garden of Eden. And the younger brother, my people, your people, we were thrown out because we were too dangerous and we didn't know how to behave and we would damage everything. We were given knowledge and sent away. So some reference there to the book of Genesis, I think. And then eventually we use this knowledge to build ships and come back. And the name that we had when we came back was Columbus. And Columbus begins to destroy, to seize, to plunder, to take everything from the land and the people. And gradually, everything and everyone is destroyed. And all that is left is this mountain, which is the heart of the world. And here, finally, Columbus is encroaching. The last process of colonization is taking place. At the same time, the world itself is dying because of all this plundering. And when Columbus conquers finally the heart of the world and occupies it, then the world dies. And you have to go and tell the world, you BBC.
Right.
They're now calling me BBC. So that's how I got involved. And that's why I decided this was probably something I'd want to do. Would you?
Absolutely. And before we continue with Alan in this fascinating conversation, and I'm riveted to your story. As a lead into the next part of our conversation, I want to play the audio portion of the soundtrack. There will be a short section of people speaking the Kogi language, but I'm sure that Alan can translate that for us at some point. So let's listen to a clip from the soundtrack of Luna.
Hidden in the folds of a Colombian mountain are the secret cities of an ancient people. In 1989, they asked me to film their warning to the world. They said we needed their help. They warned of rising temperatures, melting snows, droughts, new diseases, increasing violence. This will happen, they said, because of the damage that we're doing to the Earth. We must stop doing it. They made their film, sent me away, and waited. And we did not stop doing it. We now have climate change, AIDS, endless wars steadily spreading. And now they've called me back. Time is running out. They failed to make us hear. They have to do better. They're driven by fear of what they see will happen next. This time they're taking us into the places where life itself is born. We're being taken to a luna, the mind inside nature. Their leaders are called mamas. Mama means the sun, enlightened. But first, from birth to adulthood, they're kept in the dark. They learn to work as hidden spirit midwives to all life, keeping it in balance. And we have overthrown that balance. So they're going on a journey to expose what happens where three worlds meet. Theirs, ours, and the inner world that is now being destroyed. They say it is us who live in the dark. It's not too late to avoid catastrophe, if we open our eyes.
That was a clip from the soundtrack of the just-released documentary A Luna, the story of the Kogi people in Colombia and the vital message that they are sharing with the rest of the world. I'm Carolyn Baker, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. My guest tonight is Alan Herrera, the director of Aluna, and we're continuing the conversation with him. Alan, can you tell us briefly what the Kogi were saying in their own language?
Yes. That wasn't a clip from the film. That was a clip from a trailer. The film is a bit different. What was going on there was, at that moment in the trailer, you see the reflection of a mama staring, one of the enlightened ones, staring into a pool. And he is explaining that this water is used to establish a mental connection to Aluna itself, to the mind inside nature. And there's an act of communication that goes on between the Kogi mama and the water. And he is warning that this water and lots of water is drying up. As the world heats up, so lakes and lagoons and ponds are all evaporating, and the amount of water that there is in the world is going down. And he's saying this water is, we all depend on it, you depend on it, we depend on it, and also this is my job, is connecting with Aluna through the water. That is what a mama is and does. That's what he's saying.
Thank you so much for that beautiful explanation. And Alan, why is this movie important in a time of mass extinction, and how can the Kogi people help us in this time of unprecedented ecological loss?
The Kogi believe that what they're doing is important because they think that the reason that we cause such massive destruction to the world is, I mean, they started off thinking that we simply didn't know we were destroying the world. So they would tell us we were destroying it and then we would stop. Then, given the evidence, they realized that that wasn't quite the way it worked, and that actually we do know we're destroying the world, but we don't know how we're destroying it, and therefore we don't know what to do to stop. Now, that may not be how we see it, but their perspective is that what we don't grasp is that the world is a single living entity, and that it has the biological connections covering without and within the whole world that any living being has within its whole body. And because we don't understand that, we assume that different parts of the world are actually quite separate from each other, and that you can do damage to one, a great deal of damage, without necessarily causing any other damage anywhere else. We don't grasp how interconnected everything is. And the point of the film, from the Kogi's perspective, is to teach us how interconnected the world is. And they actually set out to do this by laying 400 kilometers of gold thread, tracing the invisible links between different parts of the ecosystem of the base of their mountain. It's perfectly true that we're not good at understanding connections. They wanted to engage with Western scientists, and they do in the film, and that's a very important part of the film, is that they are saying what we're talking about is nothing magical or mystical or secret knowledge. We're talking about scientific understanding, and we want to talk to your scientists to share, see what they know and what they can make of what we know. And the meetings with the scientists in the film are very important and very interesting, because the leading scientists that they meet end up agreeing with them completely and always saying we can learn from them. That's really important, and that needs to be started, and it needs to begin to happen. The other thing, though, which I think is I do not personally think the Kogi are telling us things that we don't know.
Right.
I think we do know these things, but I think we only know them in certain situations, and in other situations we behave as though we didn't know them.
Right.
I think that the overwhelming majority of people are perfectly well aware that nature is an interconnected and living whole, but they don't feel entitled to say so. They think they'll look like idiots if they say that in any public space, unless they're among friends. It's not the conventional wisdom. And I think that the role the film really has to play is to take part in a process of encouraging and allowing people to feel entitled and have the authority to say what they already know is true. And I think if that were to happen, you would see change on a very large scale. And I do believe that the film must be a part of that process. That's, of course, not how the Kogi see it. They see us behaving in ways that they can't believe that we know and then behave in another way, or know and then talk in another way, because we do that all the time.
Right.
But the reason we do it is because we don't feel entitled to stand up in public and say, actually, the Earth is a living, interconnected being, and we have to think very hard about any harm we do to it.
Well, this is not acceptable talk in our common parlance, in our cultures of industrial civilization. But one reason I chose Everybody Knows for the theme song of this program is because I believe everybody knows on some level what is happening to the Earth, and that the Earth is one whole living organism. Now, one of the lighter sound clips from the movie, Aluna, I would like to just play just a bit of this one. It's called Fun on the Beach, and I like it because it's light and it gives me a flavor of the culture and kind of makes me want to put on my dancing shoes. Here's Fun on the Beach from the movie Aluna. One of the lighter sounds from the movie Aluna. And Alan, I'm wondering if you would tell us a bit about Kogi culture in terms of ritual and celebration. What do you know about them? What did you discover?
The culture is, let's see, firstly, it is entirely gendered. Everything is gendered. The distinction between male and female is very powerful and very important. Every aspect of the world is gender. And men cannot survive without a feminine presence. Women cannot survive without a masculine presence. And the two are complementary to each other. Incidentally, their language also, they themselves hold long conversations about which syllables of words are masculine and which are feminine. And my experience is that every statement they make has to be balanced between masculine and feminine elements. The men's meeting house, which women do not come into, has around the four fires stones which represent women. The men themselves carry a gourd, which the word that they use for that is also a word that means womb. They put into that burnt seashells and some water, and the word for seashells is also the word for stars and for sperm and for all living things and for the Milky Way. And they have each man has a stick, which he licks and puts into this gourd and takes out some of the burnt seashell and eats it from the stick. So he is ingesting a feminine principle of life to connect him to life. and to the earth. He then rubs the stick on the top of the pot, and the remaining calcium on the stick comes off on the top of the gourd and forms a kind of collar there, which is a record of his meditation. And to me, they talk about that as the book of your thoughts. But that's a phrase constructed for me, since they do not have writing. And they're very suspicious of books. The idea of a book is something that they don't trust.
Right.
Because you don't know who's going to read it. In fact, when I proposed that I write a book to teach people how Coggy children learn how to think about the world, we spent about a year discussing this proposition, at the end of which I was asked, what happens when a bad man reads a good book? And that's a difficult question to answer. I replied that I thought the book chose the reader as much as the reader chose the book, but I don't think they believed that.
Mm-hmm.
There is the process of being given this object called a sugi to a young man is the process of, it's his bar mitzvah, it's his growing up ritual. It turns him from a boy into a man. But it's not quite as simple as that. He has to spend, my experience are usually 2 days and nights, maybe it can be more, sitting in the ceremonial house, being lectured continuously on how a man should behave. The emphasis of that teaching is on understanding that trees in particular are the absolute equivalent of human beings. And that cutting down a tree is murder.
Mm.
And that all vegetation must be thought about very carefully and treated with great respect and understood. What does it do? How does it live? Also, of course, it is a preparation for what we call marriage. And a tremendous emphasis is placed on treating your wife well, never beating her and so on. A young Coggy will be allocated by a mama to a family where he would be expected to marry a daughter in a very Old Testament sort of way, by which I mean he is going to have to work for the father of that woman for some years to establish his propriety as a mate for the girl. It's very much like the Old Testament. In fact, the whole life up there is really kind of biblical. And the role of the mama, in a sense, is rather like that of an Old Testament judge. The women, the men chew the coca leaf, which is not at all the same thing as refined cocaine. And that too is a meditative thing, but it also, builds up their endurance, given the very harsh environment of that mountain, and allows them to go for long periods without sleep or food. Women do not chew the coca leaf. They do grow the coca. They lead a separate social life. Women's gatherings have much more music in them than men's. But there are women mamas as well as men mamas. They play a different role. They're called sagas. Children are brought up. First of all, they learn to dance, then they learn to crawl and walk, but dancing comes first. A child's introduction to a boy child's introduction to the male community, but when he's led in, still unable to walk, but dancing by a mama. I, by the way, had to be taught how to dance, and this was quite a serious and heavy duty operation.
Yes. Well, you know, we kind of come down to the end of time here, and in a little bit we'll be needing to wrap up. But this actually leads, what you just said actually leads into my next question, which, how has all of this affected you personally? You know, I've had the privilege of interacting closely with a few Indigenous cultures in my life, and I know how it's personally impacted me. Can you say a little bit about how it has impacted you?
Well, obviously, it's prematurely aged me. The first thing is that I have learned an enormous amount from them. They are thinking people. They are very profound thinking people. They have powerful analytic tools at their disposal. They make me feel like younger brother. I have learned a great deal about how to think about the world. In terms of physical culture, I think the big shock when I first went there, I always thought that we live the way we do because whatever its cost, it's a more comfortable way to live. We have a kind of luxury life. So I was astounded to discover that living with the Kogi, I have never been so physically comfortable in my life. I was eating better. I was sleeping better. I was in houses where I'd never realized I can't breathe in these houses. Up there, I can breathe. I can live. I can smell. I can hear. I can taste in a way that I can't do down here. When I come back down, every time I come down, it takes me some weeks to close down my senses to the point at which I can tolerate living in London.
Mm-hmm.
I have to shut down 70% of all my perceptions in order to be able to endure it. I didn't understand that that's what we are raised for. One thing I haven't said, by the way, is that the Kogi mamas are raised in the dark from birth.
Mm.
For years, 9 years at least. And only after that do they emerge into the light.
Wow.
So they are very different from us.
Well, I assume that they live in a fairly, well, obviously remote region, way, way high. And can you just briefly tell us how much encroachment is happening upon them by non-Indigenous forces?
Much more than they would like. Since my first film, there have been massive intrusions by guerrillas, irregular military forces and regular military forces, and also a certain amount, I mean, we would regard it as very little, they regard it as an overwhelming quantity of tourism, people who go there because they want to meet and see the Kogi. And to them, this is dreadful. And they really, they are coming to the conclusion that the colonization and conquest of the mountain is now nearly complete. Much more serious, though, is the scale of industrial development, large mega projects taking place at the bottom of the mountain, which are destroying all the river estuaries. And by destroying the river estuaries, you destroy the rivers. And by destroying the rivers, you destroy the whole of the mountain. And that's actually the theme of the film, is showing how the destruction of a river estuary destroys the entire ecosystem of the river all the way up to the mountain.
Mm. Well, would you tell us about the Tairona Heritage Trust and the first film, From the Heart of the World? And if I'm mispronouncing the name of the Heritage Trust Foundation, please correct me. But
you're
tell us a bit about it.
After the first film, obviously people wanted to respond. They wanted to know what they could do, what could be helpful. And so I set up a trust called the Tairona Heritage Trust. There is a website, which is tironatrust.org. The function of the trust has been to accept donations to help the Kogi buy back land that's been taken from them by settlers and rebuild their lost communities. And that has been happening. But there is now a new project. On the day that the film was released, a village meeting, which a discussion of political issues was taking place, was struck, the meeting house was struck by lightning, struck successively by three blasts of lightning, which incinerated the house and the people in it. Seven people were burned to ashes. So was the house. 17 others badly wounded. The following day, a landslide caused by the same terrible weather buried and killed a woman and five children. A few days later, the young son, leader, the son of a leader of the Kogi political organization, who had started at university in order to learn environmental engineering and was campaigning against these projects, which he and all the Indians believe causes this catastrophic climatic events. He was shot dead. I have now been asked to go, and I'm going next week, to take the film back to Santa Marta at the foot of the mountain, where the indigenous people and the city have come together to host a free showing to try and bring people together and to launch what will be a response to these catastrophes, which is a new environmental management project supervised by the Indians. Now, this is going to take a lot of organization and a lot of political willpower and money to get this off the ground. And the Tairona Heritage Trust will be seeking funds to support the Kogi in launching an environmental management program for the mountain, which is arranged on entirely new principles of managing one river valley at a time as a whole. And they've drawn up an elaborate set of plans which are as intelligible to modern administrators and scientists as they are to the indigenous people. It's a brilliant piece of work, and this horrible, terrible Holocaust provides the platform to go forward with it.
Well, the paradox of that is amazing. And I'm wondering, if people wanted to get involved or contribute, how would they do that, Alan?
Well, the website, as I say, which is Tairona Trust, T-A-I-R-O-N-A, trust.org. Incidentally, the film Aluna is now out on, you can buy a DVD on Amazon, you can download it from iTunes, you can see it on the Vudu TV system. So it's there, and everyone in the world should see it and come to some conclusion about it.
Well, what do you most want us to know about Aluna from your perspective?
From my perspective, I just want you to know that it's there. I want you to experience it. And then I want you to tell other people, if you think that that's important, that they should experience it too. I'm not going to produce an agenda for change or anything like that. I am not a guru or a leader or a political campaigner. I've helped them put out into the world what they want to say. Now it's up to you folks to see it, experience it, and pass it on. And that pass it on bit is really important. People think it's not a bad film. I noticed that on IMDb, its rating is 8.7, which is about as high as any movie ever gets. So enjoy it.
Well, one last question I have for you, Alan. Why do you think this movie is so important in a time of mass extinction? And how can the Kogi people help us in this time of unprecedented ecological loss?
Well, I think you already asked that question. And I was saying that I think that what the movie can do is help people feel empowered to say what they really know the world is and what needs to be done to take care of it. The way the Kogi people can help us is by encouraging our own sympathetic relationship to nature as a living entity, as a whole, as a totality, and to see what's around us as a totality. The main thing, there's one sequence in the film. Over and over again, one of the mamas says, to think is to listen. That's why you have ears. Listen. And it's that openness, awareness. And I'm doing a lot of talking. And I want to quote you saying, talking isn't it. Listening is it. Watch the film. Listen.
Well, I'm very glad that I asked you the question twice, because you kind of gave me a different answer there, which I so appreciate. And I think the challenge for all of us right now is to say what we know, because everybody else knows it. And in this culture, we run into problems and obstacles when people don't want to hear what they already know. They don't want to hear it spoken directly. But I think we need the courage to speak that truth, because everybody knows. And I want to thank you so much, Alan Herrera, for this movie, for the two movies that you've given us, and this one in particular, Aluna. I want to encourage everyone to see it, to order it, to share it with your friends. Alan, I wish you the very, very best in your endeavors ongoing with the Kogi people, and thank you so much for being on the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you.
Join us again next week, folks, on the Lifeboat Hour as we continue with these fascinating guests that we've been having, and as we begin to just, you know, explore and experience deeper layers of truth and reality in this time of endings. I'm Carolyn Baker. We'll see you again next week.
The rich get rich, that's how it goes. Everybody knows.